Milt Rosenberg, Chicago's WGN Radio 720.
There's a valley in Spain called Jarama. It's a place that we all know so well. It was there that we fought against the fascists. We saw a peaceful valley turn to hell.
So I said we're going to be hearing from Roosevelt, Churchill, Ed Murrow, Dwight Eisenhower, George Patton, etc. Why now Woody Guthrie singing a song from the Spanish Civil War? Because in 1936, and that's when that was recorded, the Americans for the first time since World War I were facing Germans in battle. Yes, it was the Spanish Civil War, but there was a major German presence on the fascist side there. To be sure, most of the Americans who fought in the International Brigade were communists, more or less, many of them members of the American Communist Party. But it's the beginning of the armed confrontation between essentially Nazi power and the Western world. And from here on, we'll be going to a number of important speeches and events. And that will arouse memories, surely among the older listeners that will arouse memories, and among the younger ones who know something of our history, that will arouse questions. On and off as we go through tonight, and we'll be playing lots and lots of particular clips, but if you want to pose a question, make a quick comment, you should phone in directly at 312-591-7200, 312-591-7200. To begin with, as we lead towards the war, I'm going way back to 1934. That's even earlier than Woody Guthrie singing about the battle in Jarama Valley. But this is Winston Churchill warning about the Nazis, and he was indeed a far-seeing visionary, and indeed he was the watchman in the night, and it was a dark night before finally some dawn came through. Winston Churchill, 1934, speaking to the British people.
There is a nation which had abandoned all its liberties in order to augment its collective strength. There is a nation which, with all its strength and virtue, is in the grip of a group of ruthless men preaching a gospel of intolerance and racial pride, unrestrained by law, by parliament, or by public opinion. In that country, all pacifist speeches, all morbid war books are forbidden or suppressed, and their authors rigorously imprisoned. From their new table of commandments, they have omitted, "Thou shalt not kill." It is but 20 years since these neighbors of ours fought almost the whole world and almost defeated them. Now they are rearming with the utmost speed. And ready to their hands is this new lamentable weapon of the air, against which our navy is no defense, and before which women and children, the weak and frail, the pacifist and the jingo, the warrior and the civilian, the frontline trenches and the cottage home, all lie in equal and impartial peril. Nay, worse still, for with the new weapon has come a new method, or rather has come back the most brutish method of ancient barbarism, namely the possibility of compelling the submission of races by terrorizing and torturing their civil population. And worst of all, the more civilized a country is, the larger and more splendid its cities, the more intricate the structure of its social and economic life, the more it is vulnerable, the more it is at the mercy of those who may make it their prey. Now, these are facts, hard, grim, indisputable facts. And in face of these facts, I ask again, what are we to do?
That's Churchill, in a way, crying in the wilderness. He's not a member of government, except I believe he's a member of Parliament, but the former First Lord of the Admiralty, and a ranking British politician out of power, and essentially preaching to largely deaf ears in those days. But they learned They learned as the Nazis began to gobble up parts of Europe and did it very ferociously. To begin with, they occupied the Rhineland, which had been forbidden to them by the Versailles Treaty. Then they did work the big Anschluss. That is to say, they took Austria, a German-speaking but separate nation. They took it all. And then they developed designs against a good portion of Czechoslovakia, known as the Sudetenland, which was populated by ethnic Germans, but it was Czechoslovakia. And that generated a big crisis, and ultimately appeasement was the order of the day. Neville Chamberlain, then the Prime Minister of Britain, goes to Munich for a third conference with Adolf Hitler. At the Munich conference, Chamberlain, Hitler, also Mussolini, of course a partner of the Nazis, a partner of Hitler, and Edouard Daladier, that's a name not as well known. He was at the time the Prime Minister of France. And England and France sold away a good portion of Czechoslovakia. And Chamberlain comes back in a famous scene, gets off an airplane, and tells the world that he's achieved peace in our time.
This morning, I had another talk with the German Chancellor, Herr Hitler. And here is the paper which bears his name upon it, as well as mine. Some of you perhaps have already heard what it contains, but I would just like to read it to you. We, the German Führer and Chancellor, and the British Prime Minister, have had a further meeting today and are agreed in recognizing that the question of Anglo-German relations is of the first importance for the two countries and for Europe. We regard the agreement signed last night and the Anglo-German naval agreement as symbolic of the desire of our two peoples never to go to war with one another again. We are resolved that the method of consultation shall be the method adopted to deal with any other questions that may concern our two countries, and we are determined to continue our efforts to remove possible sources of difference and thus to contribute to assure the peace of Europe.
And that assured the peace of Europe for about 1 year. In fact, after they took the Sudetenland portion of Czechoslovakia, within the year, they gobbled up the rest. Within about a half year, they gobbled up the rest of Czechoslovakia. And then began to demand concessions from Poland and threatened that they would invade Poland because Poland was somehow getting ready to invade Germany. Not a very likely possibility, considering the comparative strength of those two nations. We pause right now for some commercials. When we return, we go to war.
Extension 720, Milt Rosenberg, Chicago's WGN Radio 720.
Recognize that music. Indeed, we've played it once or twice before on this program. That is the Ostwesel-Lied, more or less the official anthem of the Nazi Party, which became, in turn, sort of the second song for the Vaterland, after the classic one, Deutschland über alles, came the Ostwesel-Lied. And that brings us directly back to the intentions of the Nazis towards the world. They made a pact with Stalin, the Hitler-Stalin Pact, just a few months before the beginning of the war. That pact, in essence, decreed that they would carve up Poland, but they needed a provocation to go into Poland. But even before we listen to the beginning of the war, there's a most frightening speech that Hitler delivers at the beginning of 1939. Remember, they're going to war in September of 39. And on January 30th, 1939, he is speaking to the Reichstag, the German parliament. And in a famous passage, he says, "Ich will wieder ein Prophet sein." I will once again be a prophet. And he then prophesies that if war begins, it will be the fault of the Jews, and it will lead to the obliteration of the Jewish race in Europe. Die Vernichtung des Judenrasse in Europa. Hitler didn't fool around. He gave evidence even way back in 1924 when he wrote Mein Kampf while he was briefly imprisoned by the then established Weimar government of Germany. Even then he said, ultimately we got to get the Jews out of Europe one way or another. Here he's saying they will be destroyed if war comes. And the war will be their fault, even though, of course, he is planning war. He's planning an invasion of Poland, and Poland will be split up between him and the Soviets, but ultimately he's going to go on and invade the Soviet Union. That is his intention. He may pull the wool over Stalin's eyes, but it's very clear that that's what he is up to. Here's that speech. January 30th, 1939, it is to be sure in German, but he's saying what I just said he is saying.
Ich will heute wieder ein Prophet sein. Wenn es dem internationalen Finanzjudentum in und außerhalb Europas gelingen sollte, die Völker noch einmal in einen Weltkrieg zu stürzen, dann wird das Ergebnis nicht die Bolschewisierung der Erde und damit der Sieg des Judentums sein, sondern die Vernichtung der jüdischen Rasse in Europa.
And indeed, ultimately, he was a true prophet. In fact, he fulfilled his own prophecy in the Holocaust. And indeed, as modern study has shown, he also managed to kill not only the 6 million Jews, but millions of others who were in the way, who needed to be exterminated, he felt, to make room, Lebensraum, living room, for the expansion of Germany towards the east. Chamberlain was still the Prime Minister of England, and finally, he developed some spine, and as Hitler was threatening to invade Poland because of, quote, Polish provocations, Chamberlain and the French as well, the English and the French, presented an ultimatum saying that if they did do that invasion, it would be a state of war between France and England on the one hand and Germany on the other. That did not dissuade Hitler, of course. And the war began. Chamberlain still in power as prime minister, though by May of 1940, after reverses already in the field, and as Dunkirk is shaping up, that's the great British evacuation from France where they've been defeated and where the Germans have now marched into France and conquered it, pretty soon, at that crucial moment, there's a change in government. Chamberlain retires, withdraws. Churchill is called upon to take over the premiership of Britain. And they've been through terrible times. Here is Churchill talking to the British public, but really talking to the rest of the world, and surely addressing himself as well to America, which is the great bastion of potential support, and ultimately will, of course, become a partner in the waging of World War II. Churchill, June 4th, 1940.
When Napoleon lay at Boulogne for a year with his flat-bottom boats and his grand army, he was told by someone, "There are bitter weeds in England. There are certainly a great many more of them since the British expeditionary force returned. Sir, I have myself full confidence that if all do their duty, if nothing is neglected, and if the best arrangements are made, as they are being made, we shall prove ourselves once more able to defend our island home, to ride out the storm of war, and to outlive the menace of tyranny, if necessary for years, if necessary alone. At any rate, that is what we are going to try to do. That is the resolve of His Majesty's government, every man of them. That is the will of Parliament and the nation. The British Empire and the French Republic, linked together in their cause and in their need, will defend to the death their native soil, aiding each other like good comrades to the utmost of their strength. We shall go on to the end. We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender. And if, which I do not for a moment believe, this island or a large part of it were subjugated and starving, then our empire beyond the seas, armed and guarded by the British fleet, would carry on the struggle until, in God's good time, the new world, with all its power and might, steps forth to the rescue and the liberation of the old.
I should have made clear, I think I did not, that that is a speech given in Parliament shortly after he ascends to the premiership to be Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. And, of course, as he speaks towards the end of the New World coming ultimately to the aid, if Britain is defeated, if Britain is occupied by the Nazis, he is, of course, talking about the United States. And back in the United States, at the far western reach, the far western territorial reach of the United States, dawn comes up on a quiet December 7th, 1941, and here's what we hear on American radio.
Japan's game became crystal clear today. Her desire was war, war with the United States. The peace talks now appear to have been just a subterfuge, an attempt to gain time for her fleet to sail within battle range of the American bases in the Philippines. The blow struck the American public with lightning-like suddenness. Entirely unsuspecting and apathetic to the brewing war clouds, the public entered another calm weekend, stirred only to mild interest when the president last night, in a dramatic attempt, appealed to the Emperor of Japan to keep alight the lamps of civilization. But suddenly this afternoon, a grave-faced Secretary Steve Early appeared and announced that Japan has attacked Hawaii with airplanes. And here is Early's statement. Japan has attacked Pearl Harbor from the air and all naval and military activities on the island of Oahu, the principal American base in the Hawaiian Islands. Japan's special envoy, Saburo Kurusu, and Ambassador Nomura visited Secretary of State Hull at 2:20 p.m. The conference lasted only 10 minutes. A State Department announcement is expected momentarily. President Roosevelt quickly sprang into action and ordered the Army and Navy to use their full power for the defense of the United States. As soon as word of the attack was taken to the President, Mr. Roosevelt ordered the Army and Navy to execute all previously prepared plans for the defense of the United States. Secretary of War Stimson ordered all War Department personnel to report for duty tomorrow in uniform. Just 20 minutes later, Secretary Early announced that a second air attack had been reported, this one on America's mighty Army and Navy bases in Manila. America's outpost of the Pacific, mighty Pearl Harbor Naval Base, was also under heavy attack. A number of attacking planes were sighted shortly after 8 o'clock this morning. Anti-aircraft guns opened fire when the planes dive low over the base and release sticks of bombs one after another. Two warships lying in the harbor were reported sunk. The planes later returned to the attack. The Japanese have drawn first blood. The attack was a complete surprise. At Pearl Harbor, only minimum forces of the Army and Navy were on Sunday morning duty. A pall of heavy black smoke hung over Pearl Harbor. There were no immediate reports from Manila. The American naval base at Cavite, island of Luzon, was subjected to a heavy attack. Army and Navy authorities commanded all forces to their stations to resist the attack. There were no immediate reports here on the damage. In Washington, the attacking planes were identified as Japanese, but official information was scanty.
And you may well anticipate what our next sound clip will be. We're going to pause in just a moment for an update on the news, and then we go to December 8th, a meeting of both houses of Congress addressed by Franklin Delano Roosevelt in his famous Day of Infamy speech, which calls for a declaration of war. We'll hear that right after we pause for an update on the news. For that, to the WGN Newsroom and Paula Cooper.
Extension 720, Chicago's WGN Radio 720.
History, in every century, records an act that lives forevermore. We'll recall, as into line we fall, the thing that happened on Hawaii shore. Let's remember Pearl Harbor as we go to meet the foe. Let's remember Pearl Harbor as we did the Alamo. We will always remember how they died for liberty. Let's remember Pearl Harbor and go on to victory.
The Tunesmiths get to work, of course. They did that on all sides. That was a stirring song. I don't know just when it first surfaced, probably within 2 or 3 weeks after December 7th. But now the scene is December 8th. The House chamber, packed, of course, with all members of the House of Representatives and of the Senate and the Supreme Court and a great many other significant members of government, and Franklin Delano Roosevelt addresses the Congress, addresses the world.
Mr. Vice President, Mr. Speaker, members of the Senate, of the House of Representatives, yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. The United States was at peace with that nation, and at the solicitation of Japan, was still in conversation with its government and its emperor, looking toward the maintenance of peace in the Pacific. Indeed, 1 hour after Japanese air squadrons had commenced bombing in the American island of Oahu, the Japanese ambassador to the United States and his colleague delivered to our Secretary of State a formal reply to a recent American message. And while this reply stated that it seemed useless to continue the existing diplomatic negotiations, it contained no threat or hint of war or of armed attack. It will be recorded that the distance of Hawaii from Japan makes it obvious that the attack was deliberately planned many days or even weeks ago. During the intervening time, the Japanese government has deliberately sought to deceive the United States by false statements and expressions of hope for continued peace. The attack yesterday on the Hawaiian Islands has caused severe damage to American naval and military forces. I regret to tell you that very many American lives have been lost. In addition, American ships have been reported torpedoed on the high seas between San Francisco and Honolulu. Yesterday, the Japanese government also launched an attack against Malaya, Last night, Japanese forces attacked Hong Kong. Last night, Japanese forces attacked Guam. Last night, Japanese forces attacked the Philippine Islands. Last night, the Japanese attacked Wake Island. And this morning, the Japanese attacked Midway Island. Japan has therefore undertaken a surprise offensive extending throughout the Pacific area. The facts of yesterday and today speak for themselves. The people of the United States have already formed their opinions and well understand the implications to the very life and safety of our nation. As Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy, I have directed that all measures be taken for our defense, but always will our whole nation remember the character of the onslaught against us. No matter how long it may take us to overcome this premeditated invasion, the American people in their righteous might will win through to absolute victory.
What's missing from that speech? If you think about it for a minute, inevitably you recognize there is no mention of Nazi Germany. There is no direct mention of Great Britain engaged in a continued and very difficult war with Nazi Germany, not only with Nazi Germany, but with many other allies of Nazi Germany. Why isn't Germany mentioned in this speech? Because we were attacked by Japan and not yet by Germany. And there was in this country at the time a great and very popular movement which called itself the America First Movement, which argued against engagement in any distant foreign wars. That movement, during the years from the beginning of World War II up until a week after the December 8th speech, that movement remained strong. One of its leaders related to the country from an office upstairs in the very building in which I sit at the moment. Colonel Robert McCormick, who was the great head of the Total Tribune Corporation and certainly of the Chicago Tribune, and indeed was an enthusiastic originator of this very radio station, WGN. He was all for radio once it began to develop in the mid-1920s. McCormick was one of the many leading figures. Lindbergh, the great Charles Lindbergh, was another, and various members of the American Senate, all of whom stood strong against involvement in foreign wars, stood strong essentially for the position of isolationism. But, as I say, about a week after the Japanese assault upon us, Hitler declared war against the United States. Perhaps a rather foolish thing for him to have done, but he was bound to do that on the basis of the Tripartite Axis Pact between Germany, Japan, and Italy. Italy, of course, came into the war. Someone, I think it was Churchill, who spoke of him as that jackal Mussolini who came in to hit France from below after France essentially had been vanquished by the Nazi horde. At any rate, within 2 weeks, the whole show was on. We were at war, together with, of course, Great Britain, with Japan, with Germany, with Italy, and the various lesser allies of the Germans, Bulgaria, Romania, many other such Balkan nations. A quick pause for the usual round of commercials, and then back to the speeches and back to the action. rule Britannia. Britannia rules the waves. I think that is written, drawn from music by Sir Edward Elgar. I may be wrong. But at any rate, it is one of those stirring British songs and very appropriate for that time of war, of course. And Germany declares war upon us actually only 3 or 4 days after the December 8th declaration of war against Japan, so that instantly after the December 11th declaration of war by Germany, the president instantly asks for a declaration of war against them, and the game, as I say, is fully on, fully afoot. Our first Christmas in the new war is approaching, and on Christmas Eve, December 24th, Winston Churchill talks to the United States, and here's what he's got to say.
We are in the midst of war, raging and roaring over all the lands and seas, creeping nearer to our hearts and homes. Here, amid all these tumults, we have tonight the peace of the spirit in each cottage home. We may cast aside, for this night at least, the cares and dangers which beset us. Each home throughout the English-speaking world should be a brightly lighted island of happiness and peace. Before we turn again to the stern task and formidable year that lie before us, resolve that by our sacrifice and daring, these same children shall not be robbed of their inheritance or denied their right to live in a free and decent world. And so, in God's mercy, a happy Christmas to you all.
And so it was, I suppose, a happy Christmas, but also a very tumultuous one as America geared up for war. There's so much that one might want to include in a quick overview based upon radio recordings, but there's so much you can't handle and work into a mere two-hour program. So we're jumping forward. One of the great figures of that time was a man who performed on the radio, Edward R. Murrow. The name may be known, well, is surely known to older listeners, and probably lots of younger listeners have heard of Murrow. Indeed, they made a movie of Murrow's confrontation post-war with Senator Joseph McCarthy of Wisconsin. That movie was done only, I think, 5 or 6 years ago. Murrow sort of set the style and the standard for a foreign correspondent talking from elsewhere in the world, indeed talking from the war, from London first and then off into Europe, and talking to the American people and making the war vivid and real for them. I'm jumping considerably forward right now. Here is Murrow reporting on his riding along for the nature of the experience on an American bomber bombing Berlin, a rather startling thing for a reporter to do in those days. But he was embedded long before they developed the concept of embedment for American soldiers, or rather for American reporters. So, Ed Murrow, in about 1943, I forget the, don't have the exact date, reporting on the bombing of Berlin from his own participant observation.
Doc agreed, and we flew on. The bomb doors were open. Buzz called his directions. 5 left, 5 left. And then there was a gentle, confident upward thrust under my feet, and Buzz said, "Cookie gone." A few seconds later, the incendiaries went, and D-Dog seemed lighter and easier to handle. I began to breathe and to reflect again that all men would be brave if only they could leave their stomachs at home. And we were heading home. For a little while, it was smooth sailing. We saw more battles, then another plane in flames, but no one could tell whether it was ours or theirs. We were still near the target. Dave, the navigator, said, "Hold her steady, skipper. I want to get an astral sight." And Jock held her steady, and the flak began coming up at it. It seemed to be very close. It was winking off both wings. but the dog was steady. Finally, Dave said, "Okay, Skipper, thank you very much." And a great orange blob of flak smacked up straight in front of us. And Jock said, "I think they're shooting at us." I'd thought so for some time. And he began to throw D for dog up, around, and about again. When we were clear of the barrage, I asked him how close the bursts were, and he said, "Not very close. When they're really near, you can smell them." That proved nothing, for I'd been holding my breath. Jack sang out from the rear turret, said his oxygen was getting low, thought maybe the lead had frozen. Titch, the wireless operator, went scrambling back with a new mask and a bottle of oxygen. Dave, the navigator, said, "We're crossing the coast." My mind went back to the time I had crossed that coast in 1938 in a plane that had taken off from Prague. Just ahead of me sat two refugees from Vienna, an old man and his wife. The co-pilot came back and told them that we were outside German territory. The old man reached out and grasped his wife's hand. The work that was done last night was a massive blow of retribution for all those who have fled from the sound of shots and blows on a stricken continent. We began to lose height over the North Sea. We were over England's shore. The land was dark beneath us. Somewhere down there below, American boys were probably bombing up fortresses and liberators, getting ready for the day's work. We were over the home field. We called the control tower, and the calm, clear voice of an English girl replied, "Greetings, D-Dog. You are diverted to Mule Bag." We swung round, contacted Mule Bag, came in on the flare path, touched down very gently, ran along to the end of the runway and turned left. And Jock, the finest pilot in bomber command, said to the control tower, "D-Dog, clear of runway." There were four reporters on this operation. Two of them didn't come back. Two friends of mine, Norman Stockton, of Australian Associated Newspapers, and Lowell Bennett, an American representing International News Service. There is something of a tradition amongst reporters that those who are prevented by circumstances from filing their stories will be covered by their colleagues. This has been my effort to do so. Berlin was a kind of orchestrated hell, a terrible symphony of light and flame.
We'll hear more of Morrow later. One marvels listening to him once again at what poetic force he put into the narrative account of, in this case, a bombing raid. He did some tremendous reporting even earlier of the German assault on London, broadcast in the midst of the bombs falling from roofs in the heart of the city, that is, the central district of London. He, of course, became a great figure in American broadcasting during the war and then for many years after it, working for CBS and did all sorts of wonderful things on television as television got off the ground. I want to invite calls and email, for that matter. Some email has already accumulated without a formal invitation. Whatever thoughts strike you. If you have any questions, I may or may not be able to answer them. But surely your thoughts, and I'd love to hear from some of the older listeners who may remember these days directly. 312-591-7200 is, of course, the area code. 312-591-7200. Anything you want to ask or say or remember for us, do get in there and give us a call quickly. And if you want to reach us via email, the email address, as always, is extension 720 at WGNradio.com. Extension 720 as one word at WGNradio.com. Well, and for that matter, you can also get to us, I don't say this often enough, at our Facebook page. That is simply Facebook.com/Milt Rosenberg. Facebook.com/Milt Rosenberg. That's the way you get there. And I'll be looking at that as we proceed. And, of course, I see one or two lines popping up right now, but there are lines available for anybody who wants to move in quickly and offer a thought, a comment, a memory. 312-591-7200. we have much more territory to cover. We'll get right back to it after we pause for an update on the news. At the moment, we're 2 minutes away from the hour, therefore I am doing what in radio they used to call vamping, just filling the time. Not enough time to put on another clip, and a little bit too early to go to the newsroom. A good time for me to remind you that at our regular website, which is simply wgnradio.com/extension720, you've got hundreds of podcasts, all the recent programs, and lots of them quite classic, going back many years. On the first page, you see a number of those that we've retrieved. If you go beyond the first page, wherever it gives you a link to more podcasts, you'll find a great deal else, including much, I think, by way of history of and analysis of World War II and other wars and much in American history generally. As a matter of fact, we just put up the other day something that has to do simply with the history of Chicago. There is an interview with Harold Washington, come to think of it, which I did from the very position where I'm sitting at the moment, and that goes back many years. There's also something we just put up with Art Patak and the newly installed chief or superintendent of the Chicago Police, Leroy Martin, many, many years ago. I forget exactly how many, but into the 1980s. And if you listen to that, you'll find the problems we had then, we've still got now. There's much of interest historically, all the way from the history of Chicago to the history of the founding of the United States and many other important periods in the history of the United States, and many wars, including the great Cold War between the U.S. and the USSR. Directly back to our illustrated radio history of World War II, after a pause for the update on the news, and for that, to the WGN Newsroom and Paula Cooper.
When der Fuhrer says the is der master race, we right in the Fuhrer's face. Not to love the Fuhrer is a great disgrace, so we right in the Fuhrer's face. When her Goebbels says we own the world and space, we right in her Goebbels' face. When her Goering says they'll never bomb this place, we right in her Goering's face. Are we not the supermen? Are you pure?
Perhaps the funniest song of the war by Spike Jones, but I'm not sure that's the original Spike Jones recording. Sounds to me like somebody else's cover, so to speak. Either way, our first blood is, of course, in North Africa. We're going to go to North Africa shortly and hear our major opponent, namely General Erwin Rommel. But first, a call from Brian. Good evening, sir.
Good evening, Milt. I was wondering if you could comment on Admiral Chester Nimitz. My grandfather served on his staff. And he said that MacArthur seemed to have the president's ear, and that he thought that the war in Asia would have ended in 1944 if the president would just listen to Admiral Nimitz. Thank you.
Well, Nimitz was, of course, a great figure, and he was the commander of our Pacific forces, which had to be reconstituted. And, of course, they waged a major war, and very successfully, ultimately, defeating the Japanese in some great battles, particularly the Battle of the Coral Sea, as I remember it. But I fear that tonight we're focused essentially on Europe. You can't do all of the war in 2 hours with commercials as well. We must do another program sometime soon in this form with clips from radio coverage, but focused upon the war in the East, the war in Asia. I said we're going to North Africa. Here, indeed, is the major opponent. He faced the British first, and then he did, for a while, face us, Erwin Rommel. Ultimately, he faced Hitler. He was a participant in the plot to assassinate Hitler. At least he had signed off on it and given his tacit approval. And when that was discovered, he was given the opportunity to kill himself in a soldierly way with a pistol to his head, or else he would be garroted publicly. And he chose the first approach. Here is Rommel explaining why he gave up the siege of Tobruk and really giving an account to Germany in a German newsreel as to why they haven't done so well back there in North Africa, though he's on his way back to North Africa. This is, of course, in German. If you know any German at all, you'll catch on. Even if you don't, you'll hear the mention of Tobruk, and you'll hear the mention of retreat, and you'll get a sense of the man.
Griffen wir bei Michili am 6. April 1941 an. Ja, wir stießen sogar mit Teilen unserer Streitmacht gleichzeitig nach Derna, um dort schon die Küstenstraße im Besitz zu bekommen und dem Feind den weiteren Rückzug aus der Cyrenaika zu überlegen. Es folgten harte Kämpfe am Ras Madauer, vor allem im Mai, die beinahe mit Kampfverhältnissen von Verdun zu vergleichen sind. Aber der deutsche Soldat und neben ihm auch die italienischen Kameraden haben diese schwierigen Zeiten überstanden. Sie haben jeden Versuch, die Festung Tobruk zu entsetzen, abgewehrt oder uns die Stimmung an der ägyptischen Grenze zu entreißen. Es ist mir dieser Entschluss bitter schwer gefallen, Tobruk freizugeben, das wir nun über ein halbes Jahr belagert hatten, und vor dem Feind zu weichen. Und man macht sich keinen Begriff von den Schwierigkeiten, die ich damals hatte, schon deshalb, weil ein großer Teil meiner Truppen gar nicht motorisiert war.
It is interesting that Winston Churchill, even before the war was finished, spoke admiringly of Rommel, and that because he was a man of some conscience, as well as obviously a great military strategist. But as a man of conscience, he did finally oppose Hitler and join in the plot, and for that lost his life. And Churchill spoke admiringly of him towards the end of the war when he was dispatched, when Rommel was dispatched. In that, if you catch any of the German at all, he is talking about how he hated to give up the siege of Tobruk, which he thought he was going to be able to take. And he has a few comments not only about the great German soldiers, but their fine Italian comrades, which isn't quite the way the Germans felt about the Italian corps alongside them. Be that as it may, we are now launched. And when you think of Rommel, inevitably you think of his American counterpart. Surely we all recognize this from a famous movie.
All this stuff you heard about America not wanting to fight, wanting to stay out of the war, is a lot of horse dung. Americans traditionally love to fight. All real Americans love the sting of battle. When you were kids, you all admired the champion marble shooter, the fastest runner, big league ball players, the toughest boxers. Americans love a winner and will not tolerate a loser. Americans play to win all the time. I wouldn't give a hoot in hell for a man who lost and laughed. That's why Americans have never lost and will never lose a war. Because the very thought of losing is hateful to America.
That's Patton as played by George C. Scott. Now, here's the real Patton. A rather different voice, as you will discover in a minute. This is Patton after the war, shortly after, when he's back in the States, before he returns to his duty in Europe, where, as you know, he's killed in an accident. But here he is talking before a group in Los Angeles.
Coming over here, there was a very great lesson. The first 4 hours, we passed over a destroyed land, utterly destroyed. You who have not seen it do not know what hell looks like from the top. That's what Germany looks like. That's what Austria looks like. That's what any place that the 8th Air Force and the 3rd Army worked on looks like. You must remember this, that from Brest to various towns in southern Germany and Austria, whose names I can't pronounce, but whose whose places I have removed. The trail of the Third Army and the 19th Tactical Air Command and the 8th Air Force is marked by more than 40,000 white crosses, 40,000 dead Americans.
Sounds quite impressive as well, even if he doesn't have George Scott's gravelly voice. I had never heard the real voice of George Patton until we began to put all of this together. We pause for the usual reasons, and then on to D-Day.
Amen. In all knowing and we come in him on a wing and a prayer. Come in on a wing and a prayer. Though there's one motor gone, we can still carry on. Come in on a wing and a prayer. What a show,
what a show,
what a fight.
What a fight.
Yes, we really hit our targets for tonight. How we sing as we limp through the
That, of course, was a major war song, coming in on a wing and a prayer. That special treatment, giving it the structure or the cadence of a so-called black spiritual, is probably done by the Golden Gate Singers. I'm not sure on this. Trey Elling has done a wonderful job putting this whole playlist together, but I don't know whether that shows up on the background material. But my bet is that is the Golden Gate Singers. They were a great group who reigned in American radio during those war years and for many years beyond. I much enjoy hearing that right now. And now we go to a particular day, and here is American radio again. And there must be many who remember hearing this announcement or announcements like it.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, for a special announcement from the Supreme Headquarters of the Allied Expeditionary Forces from London, from Colonel R. Ernest Dupuy. Go ahead, London.
This is Supreme Headquarters, Allied Expeditionary Force. The text of communique number one will be released to the press and radio of the United Nations in 10 seconds. Repeat, 10 seconds from now. Under the command of General Eisenhower, Allied naval forces, supported by strong air forces, began landing Allied armies this morning on the northern coast of France. The communique will be repeated. Under the command of General Eisenhower, Allied naval forces, supported by strong air forces, began landing Allied armies this morning on the northern coast of France. This ends the reading of communique number one from Supreme Headquarters, Allied Expeditionary Force.
This means invasion. Ladies and gentlemen, here we are back at Columbia's news headquarters, the newsroom in New York. I've just taken the microphone out of the studio again and back into our news headquarters. You have just heard from London Colonel R. Ernest Dupuy of the Supreme Headquarters of the Allied Expeditionary Forces reading communique number one. Everything to this point has been German reports, and communique number one now says, under the command of General Eisenhower, Allied naval forces, supported by strong air forces, began landing Allied armies this morning on the northern coast of France.
And following directly here, then, is Eisenhower talking to those who composed the invasion force, the famous D-Day speech by Eisenhower, though it's well known, of course, that he had another speech in his pocket, one that he would use if the invasion were repelled and was a failure either because of German devastation of the invasion force, or the weather was also very chancy and might have made the landings virtually impossible. It all worked out to the best possibility, though still, of course, we lost 3,000 or 4,000 men on the beaches in the very first hours of the invasion. The D-Day radio speech, or the D-Day speech, conveyed, to be sure, through radio by Eisenhower to the troops.
Soldiers, sailors, and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force, you are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere march with you. In company with our brave allies and brothers in arms on other fronts, you will bring about the destruction of the German war machine, the elimination of Nazi tyranny over the oppressed peoples of Europe, and security for ourselves in a free world. Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened. He will fight savagely. But this is the year 1944. Much has happened since the Nazi triumphs of 1940-41. The United Nations have inflicted upon the Germans great defeats in open battle, man to man. Our air offensive has seriously reduced their strength in the air and their capacity to wage war on the ground. Our home fronts have given us an overwhelming superiority in weapons and munitions of war, and placed at our disposal great reserves of trained fighting men. The tide has turned. The free men of the world are marching together to victory. I have full confidence in your courage, devotion to duty, and skill in battle. We will accept nothing less than full victory. Good luck, and let us all beseech the blessing of Almighty God upon this great and noble undertaking.
We're going to pause now. That is, we'll be back to the recorded material shortly. But let's take a few calls, and let me read a few emails as well. If you want to join in the conversation tonight, there are some lines available at this instant. So give a quick response via telephone, 312-591-7200. 312-591-7200. If you'd rather be in touch via email, the email address is, of course, extension 720 at WGNradio.com. And Jan joins us. Good evening, sir.
Yes, good evening. As usual, a very informative show. The only thing I kind of have to take you to task to is I think the first time the word Germany was mentioned was when you used the recording of Neville Chamberlain saying that he had got peace with Germany. And I'm seeing this revisionism that we keep saying the Japanese, the Italians, and the Nazis.
Uh-huh.
And some people say, well, we mean the the people who are in charge of Germany, and everybody knows it's Germany. Well, you just had the Normandy invasion, and nobody says that on June 6th the Democrats landed on Normandy.
Yeah.
So just to keep us, I mean, it's Nazi Germany. It's not to be confused with present-day Germany, but I think the term Nazis should be used at least in conjunction with Germany and not just by itself.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, and I don't deeply resist it at all. It's become rather conventional to speak of those forces as Nazi. Though the interesting question is, you know, to what degree were the general tenets of Nazism, the ideology, and also the war program, to what degree were they generally accepted in Germany until things turned very badly for them? I think the research on that demonstrates that Hitler was widely admired, revered, worshipped, and obeyed in Germany, and the Nazi Party worked its will on the public opinion of the German people and until the disillusion that followed their defeat. And, you know, neo-Nazism still persists to this day in Germany, in other European countries, and for that matter, even in the United States. But to be sure, not all Germans were Nazis, and some indeed were significant anti-Nazis. You know, I had the pleasure, I've mentioned this once or twice before on the air, when I taught briefly at Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire, there was a group of elderly Germans who had settled there. They were all of the anti-Nazi persuasion. And in fact, one of them was the wife of a famous figure who helped in the plot against Hitler. His name was Helmut von Moltke. He was the grandson of a great Prussian military hero, General von Moltke. And Helmut von Moltke led a group known as the Kreisau Circle, Kreisau being the farm that the von Moltkes managed and ran. And he was caught by the Nazis and executed in the immediate aftermath of the plot to kill Hitler. His widow, Freya von Moltke, settled there in Hanover, New Hampshire, for a while. In fact, the last premier of the Weimar Republic was briefly there until he died. That was before I had arrived there. But Freya von Moltke was a fascinating woman to talk with about the anti-Nazi movement and about the horror that she and many, she and her husband came from a rather aristocratic circle, the horror they felt about Nazism, but also the rage they still felt against the German people for letting it all happen. Interesting times indeed. Thank you, sir, for the call.
Thank you.
I must tell you briefly, one listener has sent me an email and chides me for getting Rule Britannia wrong, and he's undoubtedly right. It turns out, if I could find it right now, that here we go. Tom has this aha and says, after all these years listening to you, I finally caught you in an error. The stirringly patriotic Rule Britannia was written by Thomas Augustin Arne. It appears in his opera Alfred. Originally, it was a masque which Arne wrote in 1740. Later, it was greatly expanded into the full blood opera, etc. Rule Britannia is an aria for a tenor with chorus. So I am truly wrong. Though also our very well-informed listener goes on to say that the Nimrod variation in Elgar's Enigma variations was viewed by some as a transmogrification of Rule Britannia. That may be my only excuse. Yes, I committed an error. I do that every 10 years or so. We're about to pause right now for an update on the news. For that, to Paula Cooper.
Satan, Satan, thought up a plan, dressed as a man, walking the earth since he began. The world is hell for you and me, but what a heaven it will be. When that man is dead and gone, when that man is dead and gone, we'll go dancing down the street, kissing everyone we meet. When that man is dead and gone, what a day to wake up on. What a way to start the dawn. Some fine day the news will flash, Satan with a small mustache is asleep.
Yes, Satan with a small mustache, when that man is dead and gone. Looking forward to the end of Adolf Hitler, which came pretty quickly. That's a war song I don't remember ever hearing at any point. But that sounded to me like Bing Crosby, a young Bing Crosby. We need to check that out further. What that man and his thousands of close colleagues and his millions of followers wrought was, of course, pure horror. The totally willful destruction of extermination of millions and millions of human beings. The same Ed Morrow that we featured earlier, as the war is coming to an end and as we're taking large portions of Germany, is again along with American troops as they enter Buchenwald. Now, Buchenwald was a so-called concentration camp, not designed as an extermination camp, a death camp. Buchenwald is on German ground. All the same, political prisoners and leftover Jews and various others are held there, and they're killed off in large number, largely just starved to death rather than thrown into the gas chambers, that being the method for the great extermination centers farther east in what is now Poland and the Ukraine. Here is Morrow's account of a horrifying visit to Buchenwald.
Permit me to tell you what you would have seen and heard had you been with me on Thursday. It will not be pleasant listening. If you're at lunch, or if you have no appetite to hear what Germans have done, now is a good time to switch off the radio. For I propose to tell you of Buchenwald. It is on a small hill about 4 miles outside Weimar, and it was one of the largest concentration camps in Germany, and it was built to last. There surged around me an evil-smelling horde. Men and boys reached out to touch me. They were in rags and the remnants of uniforms. Death had already marked many of them, but they were smiling with their eyes. I looked out over that mass of men to the green fields beyond, where well-fed Germans were plowing. I asked to see one of the barracks. When I entered, men crowded around, tried to lift me to their shoulders. They were too weak. Many of them could not get out of bed. I was told that this building had once stabled 80 horses. There were 1,200 men in it, five to a bunk. As I walked down to the end of the barracks, there was applause from the men too weak to get out of bed. It sounded like the hand clapping of babies. As we walked out into the courtyard, a man fell dead. Two others, they must have been over 60, were crawling towards the latrine. I saw it, but will not describe it. In another part of the camp, they showed me the children, hundreds of them. Some were only 6. One rolled up his sleeve, showed me his number. It was tattooed on his arm. D-6030 it was. The others showed me their numbers. They will carry them till they die. An elderly man standing beside me said, "The children, enemies of the state." I could see their ribs through their thin shirts. The children clung to my hands and stared. We crossed to the courtyard. Men kept coming up to speak to me and to touch me. Professors from Poland, doctors from Vienna, men from all Europe. Men from the countries that made America. We proceeded to the small courtyard. There were 2 rows of bodies stacked up like cordwood. They were thin and very white. Some had been shot through the head, but they bled but little. I tried to count them as best I could, and arrived at the conclusion that all that was mortal of more than 500 men and boys lay there in 2 neat piles. It appeared that most of the men and boys had died of starvation, but the manner of death seemed unimportant. Murder had been done at Buchenwald. God alone knows how many men and boys have died there during the last 12 years. I pray you to believe what I have said about Buchenwald. I have reported what I saw and heard, but only part of it. For most of it, I have no words. If I have offended you by this rather mild account of Buchenwald, I'm not in the least sorry.
As I said earlier, they don't make them like that anymore. That is superb, superb reporting. But indeed, greater horrors still were to be discovered as they rolled east and as the extermination centers in Poland were reached and the full truth about the millions that were brought to immolation in those centers became clear. Places like Auschwitz, Majdanek, Treblinka, etc. Let us take a phone call. Good evening, you're on the air.
Hello, Professor Rosenberg.
Yes, ma'am.
I am an 87-year-old woman, and I live 50 miles east of the Mississippi River. I at one time, I was born and raised in Chicago, educated there, and I remember the day that Pearl Harbor was struck. Mm-hmm. I was listening to a musical program when they cut in and told us the news. Years later, I was able to work for 2 aircraft companies. One was Douglas, which is now O'Hare Airport, was their location. I eventually married a man who was a member of the 9th Air Force, and he flew in a B-26, had 69 missions.
My goodness, 69.
Yes, and he was bombardier right up in the nose.
What theater? European theater? Or?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. He was there for D-Day. I have all his diary. Fortunately, uh-huh. He entered every mission that he had, returned home, and eventually years and years later, as time will do to many of us, he passed away. But I have been writing my diary for my sons, and I'm on my book 3. I'm dividing it into 20-year increments.
Goodness.
I remember listening to Edward R. Murrow. I have this thick book that was written by A.M. Sperber, and that was a wonderful book. I've read it several times.
That's a biography of Murrow, is it?
Yes.
Yes.
I remember hearing on the radio, "This is London calling."
Yes.
Yes, I get goose flesh when I think about
it. There are whole albums of his broadcasts from London.
Oh, that whole book I've read several times. It's a very thick book about his life.
Yeah. Well, how wonderful to hear from you. Thank you so much.
And I really enjoy your program, sir.
And I very much enjoyed hearing from you. Thank you so much for the call.
Bye-bye.
And if you want to call, get in there quickly. We're going to pause right now for a last round of commercials. And there's room for more calls. 312-591-7200. 312-591-7200. For email, extension 720 at WGNradio.com.
When the Yanks raise the stars and stripes on Iwo Jima Isle, through the blood and tears they won through. Bless the heart of each Yankee there on Iwo Jima Isle, resting neath the blanket of blue.
Just a reminder, of course, that there was another theater. We focused on the European theater, but lots of men lost their lives in some dreadful, difficult fighting, island to island. Island hopping, it was sometimes called, I think. And Iwo Jima was the nastiest of all of those campaigns, as one remembers having read and learned. We know of the famous photograph, which then was turned into major statuary, which of the raising of the flag at Iwo Jima on Mount Suribachi, isn't that what it's called? And that, of course, is major statuary in Washington. But the war came to an end. We go to VE Day, thus victory in Europe, May 8th, 1945. And here is a rather familiar voice.
This is your victory. Victory of the cause of freedom is every man. In all our long history, we have never seen a greater day than this. Everyone, man or woman, has done their bit. Everyone has tried, none has flinched. Neither the long years, nor the dangers, nor the fierce attacks of the enemy have in any way weakened the unbending resolve of the British nation. God bless you all.
Churchill, of course, on VE Day, I think speaking from the balcony of Buckingham Palace, with the king standing alongside. That would be King George the VI. Let's take a few more calls. Here is David, who joins us. Good evening, sir.
Yes, good evening. They brought back memories of a long time ago. I was with the 7th Army. We went into Le Havre, France. And from Le Havre, we flew to France and to Belgium. And when we went to Cologne, that was not a good building standing.
Under whose command did you serve then?
Under Patton.
Yeah, so you're part of the 3rd Army?
Right, sir.
Yeah. Wonderful.
The 3rd, the 7th, and the 5th he had. But anyway, I was with the Signal Corps, 25th Signal Corps, out of Fort Dix, New Jersey.
When did you land? How many days after D-Day?
After D-Day? No, this is before D-Day. I landed in 1945 in January. I was through the Battle of the Bulge, as I forestated.
Uh-huh.
We went into Le Havre, France.
Yeah.
And from Le Havre, we went north into Belgium. From Belgium, we went to Germany.
So you saw the worst of it. You were in the Battle of the Bulge?
Yes.
My goodness.
When we went through Cologne, there was not a good building standing, not one.
Yeah.
And, of course, I was at Weisberg when they surrendered. And I will always recall that day. I never seen people celebrate so much by losing their home, but I didn't understand it that way. But
what happened after the war? What did you do with yourself?
We were there for a period of time, then we came back to Buchenwald, we came back to Frankfurt, and I was at Buchenwald as well before.
Uh-huh, my goodness.
We spent some time in Frankfurt, and from Frankfurt we went down to Marseille, France, and I was there and was headed for CBI when the atomic bomb was dropped. We'd just gotten in out of the Mediterranean Sea into the Atlantic Ocean.
And when you left the Army and returned to civilian life, what did you do with all those years that followed?
I worked. What do you mean? How do you mean?
I mean, what did you work at?
Any old jobs, and I finally learned to do body work, and I became a body man for the last 40 years.
Uh-huh. Well, I'm delighted you called us, sir. Thank you very much.
Yes.
Very glad to have heard from you.
I never seen people celebrate so, because the day of the surrender.
Yes, I'm sure that was true.
Yes.
I'm sure that was true. Okay. Thanks once again for joining us. I was hoping a veteran might join us, and so that is particularly gratifying. Next up is Steve. Good evening. You're on the air.
World War One ended up in a tie. You know, November 11th used to be called Armistice Day. And that's when both sides decided to stop fighting because the influenza epidemic was killing more troops than the guns and bullets.
Mm-hmm.
And then when Woodrow Wilson and his British counterpart got their act together in Versailles, they treated Germany as if they lost the war and even demanded reparations to be paid to the opposing side. And don't you think that the country was very, very angry of the end result of that treaty? And I think Hitler capitalized on the population anger to do what he did.
Well, that was the very basis of the Nazi program, to undo Versailles, which represented a stab in the back.
Which it was. It didn't represent it. It was.
Well, they did lose the war. It was
an armistice. How could you say that they lost the war if both sides agreed to an armistice?
The armistice was while they negotiated to end the war. Though it was a close thing, to be sure. To be sure, they still had major force available, and much of it persisted in military or quasi-military form and provided the base for the ultimate formation of various right-wing parties, the Nazis among them. I've got an interesting email from an old friend, our friend in Australia, Mike in Sydney, Australia, who says, "Good on you, Milt." That's an Australian greeting, obviously. "This is the type of informed program we need to hear more of these days, especially in this new dark age of pop culture idolatry and pop idol politics." My, strong stuff. "Perhaps by revisiting those days which led up to the catastrophe of World War II, we might keep our generation from being filed under the label of those who are ignorant of history are doomed to repeat it." That, of course, a famous quotation from Santayana. I hope that that is the case, that we learn something from an examination of the history of great wars so that we don't duplicate those great wars. But if another great war comes, it won't come between Germany and the United States or Japan and the West or anything like that. It will come a different sort of war, by stimulated perhaps by actors who don't represent states but represent anti-state organizations, by which one means, of course, jihadist terrorism. Though one wonders about Pakistan and where it will go and who will ultimately control it and what they will do with their nuclear weapons. But those are rather dark thoughts for the end of a program. Do we have a happier thought? No, I think not, so we better stay with some of the contributions. Here is Robert. You are on the air, sir.
Hi there.
Yes, sir.
This is interesting. I'll make it short as I can. I got drafted in 66 in the Vietnam War. I was born in 45.
Mm-hmm.
I went to Germany for my tour. I was there for 3 years, married a German girl. My father-in-law was an ME-109 Messerschmitt pilot.
Ah, mm-hmm.
Got drafted out of basically college by the Germans. Had no choice. They said either come or you're dead. He flew a couple of dozen missions and eventually wound up getting shot down somewhere. He got shot down near France, but managed to get back to Germany. They put him in a ground unit in 44, and he was captured by us in the Battle of the Bulge in the Ardennes, and wound up in a prisoner of war camp in Hampshire, Illinois.
My goodness.
How's that grab you?
Yeah, there were lots of German prisoners in the Midwest.
Yeah. A lot of people don't know that. It was a farm, basically, in Hampshire, and because he was a lieutenant, he was a camp commander, and he got to travel through the NATO forces to make sure that everything was going. But then when the war was over, here's how they thanked him. He went back to Germany, and when he got back to Germany, the Germans threw him in prison for being a traitor.
Really?
Really. Because he didn't get killed in the ground war.
Sounds more like what the Soviets did to their returning soldiers.
Yeah, and he said he has now passed away, and unfortunately so is my wife. I'm married again, but he said he was never so happy to see an American flag when they captured him. He was with a bunch of kids and old men in the Black Forest, and they were running out of food. They were freezing to death, and he said it was the best thing that ever happened to him was to get captured by us and brought over here, because otherwise he would be dead.
Very interesting indeed.
Yeah, so I just thought I'd let you... That's not many people can say that. Plus, the other side of my story is I deliver my own draft notice because I worked 40 years for the post office. Nice talking to you.
Well, my pleasure. Very glad to have heard from you. Thank you, sir.
Good night.
Well, we are approaching the end of the available time. No more clips and no more music, for that matter, because we've only got about 2.5 minutes left. I trust you find this kind of programming of some special interest. I do hope you do. There's so much material available, recorded, by which one can reconstruct all sorts of significant historical periods. Historical periods since they invented radio, obviously. And I'm thinking I really would like to put together something which covers the great run of the war without a direct shot, except that various surrogate nations did shoot at one another. I have in mind, of course, the so-called Cold War between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. There's a vast amount of material available there. I think we'll try to do something like that. Meanwhile, I do want once again to invite all who know this program at all to visit our website, wgnradio.com/extension720, where you find all sorts of podcasts of recent programs. This one will be up probably by tomorrow, but where you also find classic Extension 720 programs. I think we've gone back at least into the early 80s, and maybe we'll be able to retrieve material even earlier than that. Two or so new ones have just gone up yesterday. More material will be appearing, and we look forward to hearing from you about some of the older programs. I'd love to know what you think of them and which ones you found particularly of interest. I do know from data that we get collected that is a very popular feature with WGN listeners generally. So with that, we are approaching truly the end of the available time. We'll be back again on Sunday night for a full 2-hour program. Until then, thanks to all for listening, and a most cordial good night.
When the Yanks go marching in, I want to be there for spread some joy.
When they take Berlin, the Yanks go marching in.
There'll be a hot time in the town of Berlin. When the Brooklyn boys begin,
the boys begin
to take the joint apart, tear it down when they take Berlin.
There'll be a hot time in the town of Berlin when the Yanks go marching in.
You could never keep them happy down on the farm.
The life of these
would never please. They'd shudder with alarm.
No, you couldn't keep me.